Good morning. My name is Vince, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I'm most happy to be here this morning. It's a delight to have had the opportunity to come to Shreveport and to be a part of this conference. It's been just a terrific conference, hasn't it? It's just been great. Every bit of it. I've enjoyed the weekend more than I have most, and it's just there's one thing I want to say at the beginning this morning. I think, in light of all that's been said here this weekend, that perhaps this needs saying, and that is this: it is my sincere prayer that the AA program always preserve and protect its greatest asset, the Al-Anon program. I had to make some points somehow. You know, as good a way to do it as any. you just made it easy for me, is all you did. I noticed last night when we had that countdown, which is always kind of a special thing when they do it in AA meetings, when everybody stands up who's sober forever, and we count down. We did it the opposite way last night, which I think is nice, to leave the old-timer standing at the end. But we ended up with some people brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I met a few of them here this morning. And I want you to know that we're glad you're here, and we want you to stay. We also want you to know, as Paul said last night, you don't have anywhere else to go. You have to stay. This is it. This is the end of the line. There simply is no other place. This is where you come when no one else wants you. When everyone else in the world is through with you, you come here. And we want you. And we want you to stay. We don't care where you've been, and we don't care what you've done. We don't even care what you're going to do. We're just concerned about what you're doing today. And if you want to stay here with us, we want you and we love you. Now, having said that, let me say some other things to you. I've never met you if you're new, but I know some things about you. I know that your attitude is poor. And I know that regardless of what you tell us, you think down deep in your heart that your case is different. I know that you really believe that you're not like us. But if you're like me when I was new in AA, you're stuck. You have to tell us you're like us, because everyone else is through with you. I know that if you had your choice, you wouldn't be here. Not really. That's the way that I felt when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is the way most of the people I know felt when they first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But we don't say that when we get here. We say other things to please people because we want them to like us and accept us. And that's okay. If you're new, keep saying that, because us old-timers like to hear that. And we tend to treat you better when you're pliable and reasonable. If you're hostile, you know, we kind of pass you by and go look for someone nice to work with. Now, I'd like to start out this morning and tell you about my first AA meeting. It was in November of 1965, and it was in Long Beach, California, in an area of Long Beach, California that is a very nice upper-middle-class suburban area with a lot of nice upper-middle-class tract houses. All owned by insurance salesmen, who, when they got a drinking problem, went to the Presbyterian church on Friday night, and they went to the basement there where they had an AA meeting. And that was my first AA meeting, in the basement of that Presbyterian church on a Friday night in November of 1965. And I always want to remember that the people at that meeting were nice people. They looked good and they sounded good and they looked much like you look here this morning. In other words, if you look around this room as you would have looked around that room, and someone would have said to you, pick out the alcoholics here, you wouldn't be able to pick anybody out. Nobody looks like an alcoholic here. Everybody looks like a normal, tightly wrapped package. Ordinary and normal. You all look like you have nothing wrong with you. Except I know better. And we all look like that. And as I looked around that room, that basement of that church, on that Friday night, everybody looked normal and ordinary. It looked like a gathering of insurance salesmen and their wives. It did not appear to be what I thought an AA meeting ought to look like. And if you looked around that room, you would not have been able to pick out any alcoholics, except one. You would have picked me. I had on a torn T-shirt and a ripped pair of jeans, and I had not shaved nor bathed in well over a week. And I had just spent the previous 5 days in the Long Beach City Jail due to a series of very unfortunate circumstances that were not my fault. It seems as though the Long Beach Police Department did an intervention. And I ended up, and I always want to remember why I ended up in the basement of that church. And if you're new here this morning, or if you're new here this weekend, you may or may not identify, but I like to say it. The reason I ended up in the basement of that Presbyterian church on that Friday night in 1965 is not because I was in search of lifetime sobriety. It was not because I was looking for serenity or quiet heart. It was simply because it was the only place I knew of where I could sit down and not be arrested. So if you're new here this morning, and you think that perhaps your motives are less than what they should be, welcome home. We don't care what your motives are. There is no proper motivation to come to AA. If there was, this would be a smaller meeting, I'll bet. And you'd have a different speaker, I'll tell you that. There isn't any bad reason to come here. There isn't any right reason to come here. The idea is to get here. Now, I should tell you from the outset that I'm Irish and I'm Catholic, and I'm from New Jersey. And I have had great difficulty in my life with people from Texas. And I don't know why that's happened. It just seems to be some kind of an unfortunate chemistry between us. I also am an alcoholic, and I've got bad judgment and rotten timing. And in the basement of that Presbyterian church on that Friday night, I sat in the rear of the room, which is where most new people sit in AA. Newcomers sit in the back, because if you sit up front, it implies commitment. Somebody may think you want to stay here, and you really don't want them to think that. Not really. And anyway, I sat in the back, and I sat next to a guy who was 6 foot tall, and he had on cowboy boots and a Stetson hat in his lap. And his name was Tex. Now, Tex was not sober very long himself, but he was somewhere. Well, he was at the evangelical stage of sobriety, which is somewhere in the middle of your third month. And Tex turned to me and he said, "Boy, I'm going to help you." And I remember thinking, oh my God. Why don't you go help somebody else, Tex? And the first thing he did was he repeated to me in rapid succession all of the AA cliches, one after another. And I don't know about you, but when you're new, they are dreary. If you come here searching for an answer, and some Texan starts telling you about easy does it, and I said, easy does what? And he got to the last one, and he put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, I keep it simple. And I thought, I'll bet you do. I have absolutely no trouble with that text, I'll tell you. The first thing you said made any sense. And he put some pamphlets in my lap. And I'm going to tell you, if you're new, we have a pamphlet for everybody here. We don't care who you are or what you've done. We have your case covered. We'll give you a pamphlet that tells you all about yourself. On top of the pamphlet was a card with the 20 questions on it that Paul talked about last night. We, in our, I don't know why we do that. You know what? We're obsessed in Alcoholics Anonymous with convincing new people that they ought to stay here, that they're alcoholic. I don't think we have to do that. I think if you're here today, you're alcoholic. I don't think accidents happen here. The social drinkers in Shreveport are not hanging out here this morning. I got to tell you, this isn't where they are. The people who are here this morning are alcoholic. If you're wondering about it, I can help you. You are. Or you wouldn't be here. People, social drinkers, don't wonder about their drinking. They don't get up and say, I'm going down to the AA conference this morning, and alcoholics are here. Now, what we are obsessed with giving you this test. We'll give you these. And the way that you answer these 20 questions, the more yes answers you have, makes you more alcoholic as you go down the list. And I answered those questions. I answered 19 yes. I answered no to the question, do you seek lower companions? I couldn't find any by the time I got here. And the meeting began. And it began the way most meetings begin. At least, maybe you don't do that here, but where I come from, meetings begin, they read that portion of chapter 5 that constitutes our recovery program in the book, how it works. And that's the way they started that meeting. And I suppose it would be nice to say that I heard something that awakened me spiritually, or that I had some kind of made an insightful discovery as to my living problems. That didn't happen to me. I'm the end product of 8 years of Dominican nuns and 4 years of Jesuit priests. And I don't know about you, but I didn't hear anything new in that meeting, in those 12 steps. As a matter of fact, it was all pretty fundamental, if you ask me. There certainly wasn't anything new. And it seemed to me, after I'd heard it read, that I had been exposed to and lived by most of those principles all my life. And it did not seem to make any difference in the way that I lived, or certainly didn't make any difference in the way that I drank alcohol. Not to me. So I suppose, at least on a subconscious level, that I summarily dismissed those steps. And the meeting continued. And several people got up and participated. All of them insurance salesmen, I'll bet. And they all had on suits and ties. And they were all nice, tightly wrapped human beings and they were all married to pretty blonde Al-Anon ladies who sat in the front row and did needlepoint during the AA meeting. And they all said innocuous things that had nothing to do with my life. They were nice people who got a drinking problem. They went to the Presbyterian church on Friday night, and somehow it all got better for them. And one guy in particular, he got up and said 6 months prior to that evening, why, he'd gotten drunk and he blew the mortgage payment on his house. And then he found you wonderful people in the splendid program. And now his life was just marvelous. I turned to Tex. And I said, where do you send the more difficult cases, Tex? Because, you know, I don't know what's wrong with him, but I have a lot more wrong with me than that. He said, shut up. With his typical Texan polish. And the meeting continued. And if I had any doubts as to whether I belonged there or not, they were certainly cured at the end of that meeting. Because they had, I don't know whether you have them here or not, they had birthday parties, birthday celebrations, anniversary celebrations for these middle-aged people walked up to this podium and these other jerks sang happy birthday to them. And they brought cakes with candles on them down the aisle. And I just thought, oh my God, it was just, you know, it smacked of a mental institution. You know, it really did. It was like something you would do just before dance therapy or, you know, after you worked on your wallet. You know, it was just really it. And one gal in particular, I'll never forget her, she was sober forever. And she was 110. And her name was Phoebe. And she came up to take, and they brought a cake down the aisle to her. And she was, I don't know how many years she was sober, but they had a bonfire on top of this cake. There were damn many candles. And she huffed and she puffed. And it looked like the pulmonary disease would get her first. She got the candles out. She got up here and she said her name was Phoebe and she was an alcoholic. And then she said something about, did I want what she had? I gotta tell you. You would, the answer was no, Phoebe. No, I don't. Now that was my first AA meeting. Now I don't, I'm going to tell you, though, what happened to me from that meeting forward, and it's significant, probably the only significant thing I'll say here this morning. If you're new, this is for you. This is the most profound thing about my life that I know of. For the following 3.5 years, I drank no alcohol, I used no mind-affecting chemicals whatsoever, and I participated in Alcoholics Anonymous in every way that you can participate. I did everything there was to do in AA for the following 3.5 years. I was in a meeting almost nightly. I got commitments in AA meetings. I washed ashtrays, cleaned coffee cups, set up chairs. I did everything there was to do in AA. I joined committees. I was a very big committee joiner. I joined the General Service Committee and the Institutional Committee and the if you had a committee, I got on it. I did everything there was to do in AA, except one thing. I did not take these steps. I did not take these steps. And as a result, my alcoholism got worse. My disease progressed, and I got worse. And I got worse while I sat in AA meetings. So if you are new or relatively new, or if you have been around a little while in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're sitting in these AA meetings, and you're waiting to get struck recovered, I have very bad news for you. It's not going to happen. Your disease will get worse. Mine got worse. And you know what else? I knew it was getting worse. And the people who are here this morning who are doing that know theirs is getting worse. Because it's not a secret. And on the other hand, there were other people who I'd watched come into Alcoholics Anonymous, some of them long after I had come in, they got better. And I watched them get better. And I knew they were getting better, and I knew I was getting worse. You know why? Because it's so, you can tell when people get better in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can tell when they recover here. No one has to tell you about it. It is crystal clear. It is visually perceptible. You can see it. Recovery is before your eyes. It's visible. Something happens to somebody who gets better here.
They light up their eyes. They get a sense of purpose about their lives. And they're going somewhere. And you watch them and you know it. You can tell, can't you? You know when they're going somewhere. They're what you call winners. You hear the expression in AA, stick with the winners. They're the winners. Those people are the winners. There's another group of people sober in AA meetings who are losers. And you can pick them out too. Everybody knows who they are. They're arrogant and they're hostile. And they put everybody down and nothing's right. And they're argumentative and they're unhappy and they're critical. That's me. That's what I was. And I sat in meeting after meeting. And all the things that were wrong with me that made me, that made me drink alcohol got worse. Resentments and loneliness and bitterness, it all got worse. Now, some other things happened to me on the outside that made it appear as though I was getting better. My outside life came together. I was 24 years old. When you're 24 years old, it's impossible to stay down very long. You can't do it. You bounce up. Good things happen to you. And good things happen to me. I have a good education. I come in. Incidentally, I want to put this in. I sometimes forget this. I hear a lot in AA meetings today, especially, more and more all the time. My alcoholism is not my family's fault. It is also, incidentally, not the fault of the Roman Catholic Church, as much as I'd like to hang it on. It's not their fault. I discovered a very painful fact about life and about me when I finally got around to writing that Searching and Fearless Moral Inventory. You know what that is? My life is my fault. That's bad news. But my life is my fault. It was me. I did it. No one else did it. I did it. And so my life came together. I got a good job. I go to school well is what I do. Better than anything, I go to school. And I have a degree in biochemistry from a good university in the East. And I went in the Navy, and they sent me to one medical school after another. And I got this great medical education. They educated me to go on a ship where there wasn't any physician and to essentially practice medicine. And in civilian medicine in 1966, a new profession opened up called the physician assistant or the physician associate program. And they took people with my kind of training and they licensed us to go into emergency rooms in civilian medicine and essentially practice primary medicine in the emergency room. We saw the patients and evaluated them and sutured the lacerations and prescribed medicines. We did many of the things that a physician does in an emergency room, which I suppose tonight might frighten you if you have to go to an emergency room, but I'm not doing it anymore. That ought to be a help. But there are those that are, and they're well trained and they do it well. And I did it well. I became one of the very first licensed PAs in the state of California. I went to work in an emergency room in the industrial complex in Los Angeles, and I worked nights, 12 hours a night. And it was professionally rewarding. It was monetarily rewarding for sure. I made a lot of money. And it was something I enjoyed. I met a beautiful girl. We fell in love. We got married. Everybody we knew in Alcoholics Anonymous said, "Isn't that wonderful? They're such a lovely young couple. He has a good job and a bright future, and she's beautiful. They're going to do just fine." Well, we didn't. Because a funny thing happened to me. I had not taken these steps. And I would go into that emergency room at night. And as time went on, I began to get depressed. I began to have these terrible depressions because I had no program. But I did have a good medical education. And like Paul, I know how to treat depression. I took Dexedrine, 15 milligram spanchels. And before I was through, I was taking 7 or 8 a day. Now, anyone here familiar with amphetamine abuse will understand. That has you moving right along, doesn't it? Whatever you're doing, he knows. Whatever you're doing, you do it quick. I'll tell you that. The only problem with that is, after the fifth or sixth day, and you have not slept nor eaten, and your hair stands up on end, and your eyes dilate all out, and you show up in the emergency room to help the sick, it looks bad. That's what it does. It doesn't look good. But there's a remedy to that, and Paul alluded to it last night. The answer to that problem is called Demerol. And Demerol, as Paul told you, is a narcotic. I guess it really is a synthetic, but I'll tell you, it's close enough. Narcotics, we call a lot of drugs today narcotics that are not narcotics. We refer to them as narcotics. But narcotics are opiate derivatives. They come from opium. And Demerol comes from the same family as heroin and morphine and Dilaudid. All these drugs are just, they are narcotics in the classic sense. In other words, if you inject them, you become addicted to them, physiologically and psychologically and every other kind of way. There's no ambiguity about it. You can't, in other words, I don't believe you need an addictive personality to get addicted to Demerol. What you need is a syringe and a needle. If you have that, it gets the job done. You don't have to worry about any of the psychological terminology when you get involved with things like Demerol. And I got addicted. Now, there's another phrase attached to a drug called, like Demerol. It's called controlled substance, which is a phrase that is fraught with meaning, I'll tell you. It literally means that there are human beings whose entire lives are dedicated to finding out what happened to the Demerol. I'll tell you about that. Famous Demerol trackers of the world, I'll tell you. And I have met all of them, I think. There are people like pharmacists and medical administrators and the people who are very good at it, who are the very best at it, are the folks on the State Narcotics Board. They care, I'll tell you. We say here in AA, we care, not like they care. They care more than anybody you have ever met, believe me. They really care. And early one Friday morning, they come in that emergency room and they had an inspection. And all roads led to me. And they arrested me. They placed me under arrest, like some kind of a hideous drug addict. They said, "We're arresting you and we're taking you downtown." And I said, "My God, this must be some kind of a mistake. I'm like Paul. We're professional men. We're not drug addicts." And they took me downtown, right in my little green scrub suit. We went. And I had to appear before a judge in the Superior Court a few days later. I got bailed out. I was charged with a felony, appropriating narcotics for my own use. Now, I didn't have to go to jail, and the charge was subsequently reduced to a misdemeanor. But I lost my medical license. And I was summarily, dishonorably drummed out of that profession, as well I should be. And I like to remember how I felt, and if you're new, you may identify with this, you may not, but I like to tell you that, you know how I felt when that happened to me? I didn't feel bad, I had a sense of relief. Because I didn't, you know why? I didn't have to live that way anymore. Because I wasn't proud of the way that I was living. I didn't go to school and get my education so I could go in the emergency room and steal the dope. That isn't what I wanted to do. But I had no control. And that's the way that I live. And when they took that license away, I didn't have to live that way anymore. I also was unemployable. And it all led to the summer of 1972. And this girl and I that I married, we ended up in an apartment in Englewood, California, out by the airport, in just a terrible neighborhood. And we spent the summer of 1972 living in that apartment. And the way that I spent July and August of 1972 was I drank 1/2 gallon of vodka every day. Every day, that's what we did in July and August. I'll tell you, that's all we did in July and August of 19. When you drink 1/2 gallon of vodka a day, that's all you do. You don't do anything else. It's a takes everything you have, I'll tell you. It's an all-consuming passion. It takes every moment of the 24-hour day. And it's the kind of drinking that it is, and there are many here this morning who know all about that kind of drinking. When you drink a half gallon of vodka a day, it is 24-hour-a-day drinking, and there are certain things that happen to you if you drink a half gallon of vodka a day. It's axiomatic. They happen to people who drink a half gallon. I don't even know if you have to be an alcoholic. If you drink a half gallon of vodka a day, you will vomit bile. You will be in and out of blackouts. You will have little seizures. You will never be awake, and you'll never sleep. You're in some kind of a twilight zone. And if you're like me, you don't eat. And you lose 35 pounds in July and August of 1972. And the girl, this lovely girl that I married, sat there and watched. I drank and she watched. And all the things that happen to you when you drink that way happened to me. Finally, in the beginning of September, her family came and they got her out of there. And I was just left in this apartment with no furniture and no money and no car, or very little money, and clothes. That's all I had, was some clothes. And I got over to that liquor store a couple more mornings, and I got a half gallon of vodka, and I brought it back to that apartment, and I drank it. And I was in and out of blackouts all the time. I never knew what day it was. And I came out of a blackout in Newport Beach, which is about 60 miles down the freeway. And I don't even remember how I got there, except it was in early September of 1972, and the temperature was about 120, and I had on a three-piece wool suit and a white shirt and a tie, and I was sitting on a park bench on the Balboa Peninsula looking through the classified section of the Santa Ana Register looking for a job. That's how I came to it, with a suitcase beside me with some clothes in it. I knew I needed a job, and I found a job that day, as a matter of fact. I found a job as an apprentice embalmer for a mortician in Costa Mesa, which is, I'll tell you, if you're new and you need a job, give that a pass. Don't do that. So I'm going to tell you, that was dreadful. The job paid $85 a week, and a fringe benefit was an apartment over the casket room in the back. Just awful. It was just about as dreadful as you can imagine. And the mortician was some kind of a ghoul. He was right out of Edgar Allan Poe. He drug his right foot when he walked, and he just was, God, just, you know. And he and I did not get along well. And the long and short of it is, I lasted with him for about 4 days, and I got drunk and I stole his hearse. Is what happened. And I came out of yet one more blackout, driving the wrong way on Pacific Coast Highway in a stolen hearse with a young lady next to me who I did not recall meeting, who was screaming hysterically. And I remember thinking, I'm predisposed to get involved with neurotic women because, you know, all the women in my life end up screaming. And I told this gal that. I said, you're unstable. You really are. You really overreact, and I don't know why you behave this way. And she even did this even after I got this damn thing turned around going in the right direction. She continued to scream. And that was September the 20th, 1972. And what's remarkable about that night is from that night to this, it's been unnecessary for me to drink any alcohol or use any mind-affecting chemical whatsoever. And that's... Well, it's good news, especially if you're me, but it's the most amazing thing about that night, I suppose, is if you would have told me, if you could have materialized somehow in the back of that hearse, and if you would have told me, if you would have said, you know what's going to happen to you? Tomorrow morning, you're going back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for the next 14 years, you're not going to drink any alcohol, and you're not going to use any mind-affecting chemical, and... You know, that's fine, but more than that, you are going to become desperate enough. There will be enough desperation about your life to motivate you to take a series of actions that are seemingly unrelated to what you perceive to be wrong with you, and as a result, you are going to get a measure of recovery from alcoholism. Now that would have got my attention. Because I would have been willing to admit to you in September of 1972, first of all, the jury was in, my life was in very bad shape. Even I would admit it in September of 1972. And I would also have been willing to admit that I needed a lot of help. But I also knew that whatever help I may or may not get, it would not come in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I had been to AA, and AA does not work for me. My case is different. Might work for you, but it doesn't work for me. But I'll tell you what. It got to be 6 o'clock in the morning, and I brought this guy's hearse back to him. And he was upset. He had called the police. And I pulled into the parking lot. He called the dogs off, but he wanted his hearse back. And he threw my clothes out the window from the apartment over the casket room. And they were strewn all over this parking lot. And it was at 6 o'clock in the morning. I had no job, no car, no money, no place to live. My clothes were all in a cardboard box in the parking lot of a mortuary. I don't know about you, but every time I get in that kind of shape, I go to AA. What I do. There wasn't much else available in September of 1972. There weren't any treatment centers or, detoxes. All there was the Costa Mesa Alano Club, which was, I guess you have Alano clubs out here. You know what I'm talking about, I'm sure. And the Costa Mesa Alano Club is grim. It is not really a... It is really depressing, is what it is. It's just this grim little hovel, and they have these AA meetings there, and they had a coffee bar. And I staggered into this Alano Club at 9 o'clock in the morning with the cardboard blocks with all of my earthly belongings. And I sat it down, and I sat at the coffee bar, and I had a cup of coffee. And the manager of the club told me they had an AA meeting there starting at noon. And I sat through that AA meeting. And I guess it would be dramatic if I could tell you that I had some kind of a spiritual awakening, or I heard something, or... Something changed. Nothing changed. It was the same dreary seven Texans, I'll tell you, that I left. Sitting around a table, drinking coffee, telling each other how wonderful it was that they put the plug in the jug. Gee. And they had another meeting there that night. And I sat through that meeting. And that was the same as the other one. And it was just dreadful. The manager of the club let me sleep on the sofa, so I didn't have anywhere to go. And the next day, I got in a gin rummy game with some ladies there. And I won $27, I think. And I went out and I rented a room on Federal Avenue in Costa Mesa for $11 a week. And that room was precisely what you would imagine an $11 a week room to be like. Think about it, and you're right. It's what it is. And when I moved in there, I thought, my God, I can't. I'm going to have to stay here a couple weeks until I can get it together. So I can make some kind of a move. I don't think I can live here that long. I've never lived in a place like this. And I just don't think I can stay here for that long. 2 years later, when I moved out of that room, really didn't look that bad. Things were in perspective 2 years later. What happened to me during the next 2 years is absolutely remarkable. Now, what you should know is those next 2 years were probably the most significant, important 2 years of my life. And I was probably doing better during those 2 years than I had ever done in my life. But I didn't know it. I didn't know that was going on. If you would have asked me during that period of time, I would have told you, my life is terrible. I'm ready to commit suicide. I live in an $11 a week room. I can't hold a job. I have a degree in biochemistry from Cornell University. And I remember going back to that $11 a week room one day, and there was a letter there from Cornell saying that they were having a class reunion. And did I want to come? I remember, I'd get in a terrible depression. I got and lost a series of jobs that are absolutely hideous. I got and lost a job as a gas station attendant for being incompetent. Let me tell you, what I did was, I had one Saturday morning, I had these gas pumps going in all these cars, and I locked all the wrong gas caps. So the people left with a key that did not fit the particular gas cap that was on their car. And I don't know how I did that, but I managed to get it done. And, And about 3 days later, the owner of that gas station said, "We've got to let you go." He says, "It's too bad." He says, he was from Texas, too. True story. He said, "I'll tell you what, son." They always called me son. "So I'll tell you what, son, we got to let you go." And he said, "I can see you're a trier." He said, "You're trying very hard. That's obvious. But you're not quite bright enough for this kind of work." So I lost that job. A little while later, I got and lost a job as a drill press operator in a factory. If God made a worse job than this, I don't know about it. I'll tell you, it's the most God-awful, terrible. The factory was a stone edifice in Costa Mesa that looked like something out of Charles Dickens. It was just a stone building. And you walked in there at 6:15 in the morning, and you sat on a stool. And they wheeled up a big cart with 1,000 copper plates in it that were all embossed in the middle. And you took a copper plate and you put it under the thing and you pulled the handle down and it made a hole right where this copper plate was embossed. And then you put it in this bucket. And when you fill that up, they brought you another bucket. It was the most mundane, idiotic, and you did it just by rote. I mean, that's what you did. And at 10:10, they rang a buzzer. And you got off that stool and you ate a tuna fish sandwich. And at 10:25, they rang another buzzer and you got back on that idiotic stool for $1.87 an hour. I mean, you can't screw that up. I did. I lost that job. I put the hole in the wrong place on about 800 of these copper plates one day. And the foreman came up to me, who was originally from outside of Dallas, and said to me, "We got to let you go, son." He said, "You're just not up to this task. You're not quite bright enough for this kind of work." And I said to him, I said, "Look, you jerk, I graduated from Cornell." He said, "Yeah, well, you better go back and take the course in drill press operating. I'm going to tell you, because you know, you're not up to it." And I remember I left that, that was in February of 1973. And it was a rainy day. And I walked out of that factory and I walked back to that Alano Club. And I was probably about as depressed as I'd ever been in my life. It was raining and I just didn't know what was going to happen to me. I'd lost a job as a gas station attendant and a drill press operator, and it happened to be on a Thursday. And on Thursday night, the big meeting in Newport Beach meets. It meets down on the Balboa Peninsula, the Evel Club, and it's a great meeting is what it is. It's a very affluent community, Newport Beach, and the people, this Evel Club, this meeting on this Evel Club, what they do is they tie their yachts up out back and they come into the meeting, and I would get depressed in that sucker, I'll tell you. I would go in there and it would really be grim. And it wasn't their fault. They were great AAs. It was just that it was just terrible. And I sat through that meeting that night, and I don't remember who talked, but it was just awful. It was just awful. And I ended up going back to this $11 a week room that night. And I was about as depressed as I had ever been. As a matter of fact, I was consumed with despair. I knew that I was done. I was finished. I was 31 years old. I couldn't function. I couldn't hold a job. I couldn't, I was just dead in the water. And I was so desperate that I was moved to do something that night out of utter frustration and desperation that I knew would never work. It was the stupidest thing I had ever done. I found myself on my knees beside that bed. And I said a prayer. A very simple, unsophisticated prayer. "God, please help me. Because I'm alone and I can't make it anymore." And if you were new here this morning and you'd like to know how you start in Alcoholics Anonymous, get away as I know of. And the beauty of that is that you don't have to believe in that God. You don't have to think it'll work. You can be absolutely convinced that it will not work. But if you are willing to take the action, if you are desperate enough to take that action, if you'll do it in spite of your best judgment, if you'll do it in spite of everything you know, the promise of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it'll work. And you'll get better. That's a promise here. It'll work. You're home free if you do it. You got it made. Now, I didn't know that then, but I did it. And I didn't know it was going to work. And it didn't work as far as I could tell right away. Nothing changed. I went back to that Atlanta club the next day. There was a guy hanging around that Atlanta club who was also from Texas, incidentally. But he was a guy that was, he was sober about 11 years at the time. And he was saying things to me that were, no one else would say. He was saying things to me like, it's going to be all right. You're going to be fine. You can't miss, kid. He'd say, you're going to be all right. You're going to do fine. And as soon as you're sober a while, things are going to happen for you. He was in the floor covering business. And his name was Clarence. And Clarence said, hey, look, how would you like to go to work for me? I'll hire you. I'll pay you. I don't make much, but I'll pay you $10 a day, and you can be my gopher. You can go for the coffee and go for the tools and help me carry the carpet in. And I'll tell you, you know, things are a matter of perspective. That sounded to me then like the presidency of General Motors. He said, I'll pay you $10 a day and provide your meals. So I went to work for Clarence, and I was his gopher. And I worked for him for almost 18 months. And I went for the coffee, and I went for the tool. Clarence paid me $10 a day, and he provided my meal. And my AA program consisted of saying this prayer every night. And pretty soon something happened to me a couple months down the road. I began to feel better. And it mystified me. I didn't know why. Why should I feel better? My life was awful. Why should I feel better? But it occurred to me one day, one bright sunny day in the spring of 1973, out in that truck with Clarence, that I didn't have to drink and I didn't have to use drugs, and I was somehow free of that, at least for right now. And I remember when I went back to that room that night and I said my prayer, I added something to it. Thank you, because I'm making it. And I began to acquire some material possessions in some time of my. I got a 1964 red Chevrolet convertible with no brakes and a hole in the top. And I drove that to meetings in Newport Beach. And I'd pull that into the parking lot of the Ebel Club, and they'd all get their Mercedes and BMWs and put them on the other side of the lot, I'll tell you that. They were always asking me questions like, do you have insurance on that thing? You know, that was a big question. You know, hell, I hadn't had a driver's license in 3 years. Why would I have insurance? You know, it was just a redundancy. And that's what my life was like. And pretty soon my first birthday had come and gone. And pretty soon my second birthday had come and gone. And I still worked for Clarence. And I was 2 years sober in AA. And it occurred to me that I needed a sponsor. I'm not a very quick study. I was 2 years sober. And it occurred to me I needed some kind of direction in my life and discipline to improve my life. Now, there was a guy in AA who was a big shot guest speaker. And I would tell you from the outset that I did not like him. He was arrogant. And he was self-serving, and he was pompous. But I'll tell you what he was. He apparently had an amazing facility for helping losers in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'll tell you, we'd watch guys from Orange County. They'd get this guy for a sponsor. They would join his fascist AA group on the west side of Los Angeles. And they would do a series of things that had nothing to do with AA, as far as I could tell. And they would get better. Their lives would come together. We had one guy in particular, I'll never forget him. He was a biker. He was just a gross Manchester Red, the biker. Okay, now let me tell you about Manchester Red. Manchester Red had terrible matted hair. He was filthy, and he never shaved or bathed. And he had all his teeth kicked in the front, and he hung out in meetings with a Canadian Club bottle in his back pocket. He was always drunk. He just wanted to start fights in meetings. When you walked into a meeting and you saw Red, you thought, oh my God, you know, geez, this is a trial. Red went and got this guy for a sponsor. And about 6 months later, he showed up in Newport Beach. And he was clean shaven. And he had on a suit and a tie. And he behaved like a gentleman. And he got up to the podium and he informed one and all that 6 months, you know, that 6 months prior to that night, he'd made his first child support payment in 10 years. And that next week he was planning to vote in the presidential election. For the Republican, too, I'll tell you. Which really. So I guess Red pushed me over the edge. So I called this guy up and I said, I need some help. And he said, why don't you come up and have lunch with me? He ran a mission on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And he said, why don't you come up with me and have lunch and we'll talk about it. So I drove this old car up to Los Angeles, and I parked in front of that mission. I went in, I talked to this guy. And the first thing he said to me before I even got in his office, he looked at that car, he said, do you have insurance on that car? And I said, no. He said, give me the keys. You have a driver's license? I said, no. He said, give me the keys. I said, why would I give you the keys? And I'll never forget the answer he gave me. He said, you should give me the keys because law-abiding citizens such as myself have a right to drive in safety on the city streets and be protected from morons like you. I gave him the keys. How do you argue with that? We went in his office and we sat down and I told him I asked him to help me. He said, well, I'll help you. He said, I'll be willing to help you on one condition. And that condition is that you're able to accept the proposition that your best judgment about your life brought you here. And that my judgment about your life is better than yours. And if you're willing to do that, I'll help you. Well, I was desperate. So I made this unholy pact with the devil. I agreed to this terrible proposition. And he said, well, what I want you to do is I want you to move into this mission and live here. And I said, wait a minute. I live in Newport Beach. Why would I want to move into a mission on Skid Row in Los Angeles? He said, do you have a better idea? I said, when do you want me to move in? So I wanted to, he says, then I want you to move in here and I want you to come down to my office every morning. And I'm going to give you $8. And I want you to take this $8 and go outside and get on the bus and ride up Wilshire Boulevard. I want you to put on that suit you have. And I want you to get a series of bus transfers along the way. And I want you to go into all of the medical practices and hospitals. And I want you to talk to the administrators. And I want you to tell them that you've lost your license, but now that you're 2 years sober in AA, that you don't drink and you don't use drugs and you're an active AA member and you need help getting your license back and you need a job. And I said, that's the most preposterous thing I've ever heard of in my life. And he said, do you have a better idea? I said, give me the $8. And so every morning I'd report to his office and I'd get that $8 and I'd go outside and I'd get on that bus. And at the end of the day, I'd end up in West L.A. and I'd go to a Pacific Group meeting in West Los Angeles and I'd end up taking the bus back down to the mission where I live. And you want to know how long I did that? I did that for 8 months. I lived in a mission on Skid Row in L.A. for 8 months. I was 2 years and 8 months sober. I had no job, no car, no money, and an AA program that consisted of this childish prayer and a thank you every night. And I had no hope and no future. And everybody I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous was doing better than me. Everybody. And one morning, on a Friday morning in May of 1975, I went outside, I got that $8. I went outside and I didn't bother to tell him how depressed I was. He didn't want to hear it anymore. He was unkind, very cruel man. I went outside and I got on that bus and I had on this three-piece suit. And the first thing I did when I got on the bus, I set down this big wad of chewing gum. And I got it all over the back of my suit. And I just was so... And I rode the bus up as far as Western, which is about halfway between West Los Angeles and downtown. I got off and I went into the service station and I tried to clean the chewing gum off the back of the trousers of this suit. And I used wet paper towels. And I just got to be a disgusting mess. The gum went all down the legs and it just was... Oh, God, it was awful. And I thought, you know, I am the worst loser I have ever known. I mean, the worst loser in Western civilization. There is no one more grotesque than myself. I mean, I couldn't be successful at anything. And I put my pants back on and I had about $7 and I thought, I'm going to get something to eat and go to a movie. Maybe if I can sit in a movie this afternoon, I won't drink. That's the best I can do today. And I went outside and I got back on that bus and I rode to the end of the line. I went into this cafeteria in Santa Monica and I got a tray of food and I sat it down. I went outside to buy a newspaper and the busboy came by and took the tray when I was getting the paper. Took my lunch. And I went outside and I just, there was the UCLA campus was down the street and there were some movie theaters in the village there by the campus. And I thought if I just go to the movie, I'll survive the day. And I walked through Westwood Village and I walked to the Bruin Theater. And I stood in line at the Bruin Theater to buy a ticket to the movie. And while I was standing in that line, as depressed as I had ever been in my life, somebody called my name and back at me. And I turned around and it was the administrator of the medical center in which I had been arrested in for stealing drugs. And he said, "My God, where have you been? We thought you were dead or in an institution." And I said, "No, I'm sober 2 years in AA. And I don't drink and I don't use drugs." And he said, "My God," his eyes lit up and something came over him. And he was just so happy to see me. He put his arms around me. He started to cry. He said, "I'm so glad to see you. I'm so glad you're all right." He said, "How are you?" I said, "Well, I got this chewing gum all over my rear end. But, you know, aside from that, I'm all right." He said, "When's the last time you've worked?" I said, "Norm, I haven't worked in a long time. My license has been revoked." He said, "My God," he said, "we've just had a urologist who's joined our group practice, who's on the medical quality assurance board for the state. Come down and see him tomorrow. I'll arrange it. We'll have lunch. Perhaps he can write some letters and get your license back. And if he can, how would you like to go to work in that same emergency room?" I went down and I saw that urologist the next day. He wrote some letters. Within 60 days, my medical license was restored in the state of California. I went back to work in the very same emergency room in which I was arrested in for stealing narcotics. I worked there for the following 2.5 years. And you know what? No drugs were missing. And the patients that went through that emergency room received good care. I know, I gave it to them. Amazing things happened in my life. I took these steps, 1 through 12. All of them. I wrote a searching and fearless moral inventory. I put the secrets down. All the things I was never going to tell anybody, I wrote down. And then one night I took a ride with this sponsor. He was talking out in Colton on the desert. And I read this inventory to him with a flashlight underneath the dashboard of the car. And he told me how I should go home and get into 12 and 12 and take the 6 and the 7 steps. And I did that. And I got through these steps. And amazing things happened in my life. I became successful. And I suppose it would be nice to tell you that that's the end of the story, that from that day to this, everything's been wonderful and no bad things have ever happened to me. Well, I want you to know, if you're new, that's not what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. You do not get absolved from tragedy in AA just because you don't drink anymore. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program that's designed to take emotionally crippled children like you and I and allow us to walk through life like real adult human beings. We can walk through tragedy and triumph, and we don't have to drink. And we can behave like adults. That's what's happened to me, at least most of the time. And I've had bad things happen to me in sobriety, and I've had good things. My life today is remarkable. It always wasn't that way. In August of 1976, I met a cute little redhead. And I fell in love with her, and we met in August, we married in September, and divorced in October. And the last time I saw her, she was on the way back to her daddy's ranch in El Dorado, Texas. And I did a lot of things. I went to law school for a while and decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. And I'm in a new profession today. And it's a profession I never would have been in had I just by a series of events that happened, I'm in it and I'm successful. I have my own business and I'm married to a beautiful woman who's sober 11 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. We walk this way together. And I like to remember that she's taught me tremendous things about relationships and about women and about life. The primary thing she's taught me is, you know, I don't know if there's anybody out here that identifies this, but you know what I learned from this woman? Women are not the enemy. They're not the enemy. We're a team. We're partners. We walk through this life together. And not only do we love each other, but a more remarkable thing about our relationship, I think, is that we genuinely like each other, which sometimes I think is more important than the love. I think if the like's there, the love follows. I have my own business. She works for me. I have an office on the 4th floor of the Travelers Building on Wilshire Boulevard with a big picture window that overlooks Wilshire Boulevard. And I own a house in Pasadena. And my life is just tremendous. It's just, you can't get from where I was in September of 1972 to where I am today. The distance cannot be traversed. You can't get there. It can't happen. And yet, it's commonplace in Alcoholics Anonymous. on days when I don't feel good, when I think that I'm not getting my just due, which incidentally I hope I never do. I quit praying, I don't know about you, but I quit praying for justice a long time ago. I pray for mercy, is what I pray for. On days when I feel like I'm not getting what I deserve, I walk to that picture window and I look out and I look for that number 83 bus coming up Wilshire Boulevard. And every time I see it, why, I know I'm okay, that life's all right. And if you're new, I'll leave you with this. And I always like to remember why I'm here. Sometimes today in AA, I think we tend to forget. The reason that you and I are here today is not because of any great scientific discovery about alcoholism. It isn't because science has come up with a medication or a theory or anything. It is because, simply because, a defunct and broken stockbroker who happened to be 6 months sober stood at the turning point of the biggest crisis in his life in a hotel lobby in Akron, Ohio. And he didn't know whether to... On his right was a cocktail lounge where he could go in and drink because his sobriety was... What's the use? He had just had the biggest business failure he'd ever had. And he could either go in there and get drunk, or on his left was a church directory. And he could look for somebody to help. And thank God for you and I, he looked at the church directory. And I don't think that was an accident. I think it's a gift from God. And I think it's yours and mine. And I think it's our responsibility to value it, protect it, and to give it away. Thank you for inviting me to Shreveport.